From the studios of KPCW in Park City, this is Cool Science Radio.
Science and technology that's accessible and entertaining.
If we can understand it, you can understand it.
I'm Lynn Ware Peake.
And I'm John Wells.
Well, it turns out that human bone is versatile and entirely unique. It repairs itself without scarring. It's lightweight, but responds to stresses, and it's durable enough to survive for millennia. In his new book, Bones, Inside and Out, orthopedic surgeon Roy Meals explores and extols this amazing material that both supports and records vertebrate life. Dr. Meals examines the biological makeup of bones, demystifies how they grow, break, and heal, and compares the particulars of human bone to variations throughout the animal kingdom. Dr. Roy Meals, welcome to Cool Science Radio. It's great to have you.
Well, thank you. I'm pleased to be invited.
Well, let's start with something that I didn't know just from my intro, that bone repairs itself without scarring. I had this idea that you have a fracture and it repairs and there's a little bump left. There's a little scar tissue, but not so, huh?
That's right. I call bone the world's best building material, and this is one of the reasons why, is that, you know, if we cut skin or have an injury to our liver, yes, it heals, but it heals with scar tissue. And when you cut your skin, you know that that scar is never quite as soft and as flexible and has as much sensation as your ordinary skin. But the remarkable thing about bone is that it doesn't heal with scar, but it heals with bone. And that, yes, for 6 months or a year, you will have a little blip there, but that as the bone remodels itself, typically if you took x-rays of both sides, say 2 years later, you would find an entirely normal bone. And if that bone was biopsied, you would see entirely normal bone microscopically and no scar tissue. So it's remarkable in that regard.
And then to expand on that, in terms of the healing of the bone, I have heard sometimes that the bone will be even stronger there because more, say, calcium goes to help it heal. Is that true, or is it just the same as the rest of the bone?
No, it would be just the same. It would only be stronger if, in fact, you used it more. Perhaps during your rehabilitation, maybe you hadn't been in the habit, let's say you broke your wrist and you hadn't been in the habit of pumping iron. But then as part of your rehab program, the therapist got you on a regular exercise program and were stressing the bone more with the weightlifting. In that instance, the bone does respond to that additional stress that's put upon it and it would, in fact, become stronger and denser. And that's the basis behind exercising regularly, walking or jogging, to maintain the bone strength in our spine and in our lower limbs, because particularly as we get older, the bone tends to melt away, particularly in women post-menopausal. And by stressing the bone with regular impact exercise is that it stays strong and reduces the risk of fragility fractures.
If you're just joining us on Cool Science Radio, we're having a conversation with Dr. Roy Meals. His new book, Bones, Inside and Out. Well, Lynn and I live in Park City, Utah, northern part of Utah. Southern Utah is just a very special place for paleontologists, and it almost seems every year they're finding a new species or variety of dinosaurs. And as you say in your book, we can go back 500 million years into the past and look at bones and learn from them. And for our own human development, starting with Lucy 3.2 million years ago, I'm curious, though, since we're getting new dinosaurs being discovered on a regular basis, what percentage of bone fossils do you think have been unearthed, and what possible surprises await us in the future?
That's a great question. I asked that to a paleontologist when it began to dawn on me that we've probably barely scratched the surface, both figuratively and literally, because the bones were silted in when all of the area across Utah and Wyoming and Kansas and Nebraska, this was a shallow sea. And when these animals died and were silted in and became fossils, is that the only way we discover them now is to see them if the soil has been weathered away. And so that's why the paleontologists like to go out every summer and see what has been exposed since last year. Also in riverbeds, in cuts that the construction companies make for roads, and even in construction sites in cities. And so that consider that I don't think we'd ever know what all of the fossils were available across Utah and the Plain States if, in fact, we didn't systematically go into the bulldozer and excavate a couple hundred feet. And, of course, that's totally impractical. Mm-hmm. And so that understanding with these limited explorations that we have into the deep soil and the phenomenal number and the phenomenal variety of fossils that have been found is that I think that paleontologists have good job security and that we'll be discovering new bones and for eternity.
Yeah, it's very exciting. So, as you said, we just scratched the surface, and it's going to be interesting. Let's talk about technology for a moment. How can sophisticated scanners and their sophisticated software and 3D printing help us understand bones better?
That really starts back in 1895, almost exactly 125 years ago, when Rankin first discovered X-rays. That brought orthopedics into the modern realm when we could image bones without actually seeing them. And then with the advent of computerized tomography in the 1970s and magnetic resonance imaging in the 1980s, is that this gave us other means of even better visualization of the bones. And because CT scanning and MRI scanning can be adapted to computer imaging, well, not computer imaging, but the computer demonstration of the images, well, then, for instance, if there's a pelvic defect or an artificial joint, that these can be imaged and then use this computer data to 3D print a substitute, or even in a complex facial fracture or a complex pelvis fracture, is that the surgeon may have a 3D solid model of those sections of bones printed out to be able to study them preoperatively and anticipate where to make cuts and place hardware and so forth. So it's really remarkable in terms of the preoperative planning for the surgery, and then also in instances of fabricating implants preoperatively that custom fit the defect.
Dr. Mehls, it's interesting that with even the onset of technology, we still can't come up with something as perfect as a bone, of course. That's sort of intelligent design, or however you want to call it. But I'm wondering, for example, in your book, I saw a picture of an X-ray of a new hip, the head of the femur, a hip replacement. And I'm just wondering, what are the materials that they're finding the most luck with in terms of mimicking bone, and where is that particular technology?
Well, the total joint replacements that have been very successful, they started with the hip and the late 50s and early 60s, and then moved to the knee, and now there are joint replacements for ankles and elbows and shoulders and wrists and jaw bones and so forth, and that they don't really mimic the bone. They are typically made out of titanium or stainless steel on one side of the joint, and then a high density polyethylene on the other side of the joint. The trick with these implants is to make them durable, make them so that they don't wear out, that the polyethylene doesn't just wear thin, and then is to make the body adjust to them. Not make the body adjust to them, make the implants adjust to the body so that they will remain in place and remain rigidly fixed. That's ongoing research. It gets better all the time. I'm sure we have more to learn, but that these joint replacements, and particularly in older people who are otherwise fit, but that just hurt every time they walk up the steps or stand up from a chair, is that this has really been a marked improvement in their quality of life to have these artificial joints available.
Because you've written a book about bones and you make the great case for how wonderful bones are, in fact, while it's not a competition, they are far superior to the connective tissue, ligaments and tendons, because lo and behold, after many decades of use, we end up having bone on bone because the cartilage or whatever goes in between has failed. And I'm just wondering, there then becomes sometimes an issue with bones where you have calcification go in to try to heal, I think, and then it builds up, you know, spurs or things like that. Can you talk a little bit about that process?
Sure. The cartilage is another amazing tissue, but that it unfortunately doesn't regenerate itself, and so that it has a limited life expectancy, and that that expectancy is cut short, of course, with an infection. If there's a fracture into the joint where the joint surfaces are no longer smooth, there are a variety of reasons why cartilage can wear out sooner than it does. And so then when this cartilage is at surfaces, the joint, when it gets ground away, well, then, yes, you do have bone on bone, but that's really not the bone's fault. It's, you know, incredibly durable, and it can regenerate itself. So that's the point of the total joint replacement, is to resurface the joint with a smooth, gliding surface that will allow painless motion.
So right now across the country, I mean, who knows how many hip replacements are being performed as we do this show. And it always amazes me, the technology today and the surgeons today and the shoulders that they stand on that have come before them, that the, you know, the pioneers that came, that did all the experimenting. And you talk about Sir John Charnley, who just kept working these hip replacements, and bacteria was the enemy. And at some point he had a space suit on with ventilation for he and the staff, and they had additional filters, and still the bacteria was coming. And then they started bringing the cleanest air to the area where the incision was. And these surgeries that are going on as we do our program, they would not have happened if it wasn't for people like Sir John Charnley. Tell us about him.
Well, he was a Brit who started his research in the 1950s, and that he was really motivated by a patient's wife who said that that her husband had a primitive total hip replacement, and that it worked reasonably well, but that every time he stood up from the dinner table, it squeaked loudly, which greatly disturbed her. And so John Charnley set off on a lifetime quest of making a low-friction total joint arthroplasty. And he went through a variety of various materials, but finally happened onto this high-density polyethylene for the pelvis side, the cup side of the ball and socket joint. And once he realized that that was good, well, then because you're putting this big artificial pieces of material in the joint, is that it makes it prone to infection. So that he really worked hard on getting clean air in the operating room and clean air around the operative site. And he did, in fact, have all of the operative personnel in these spacesuits with their own circulatory system for the air that was completely separate from that in the room. And then he devised a laminar flow air system so that the cleanest air in the room was the air around the incision. And then as you got closer to the door and to the floor, is that there may be bacteria, but that wasn't any problem. And so he really was monomaniacal about this, and that it was a long time in coming before people appreciated that his work was valuable. And then, in fact, the worldwide surgeons beat a path to his door to learn the technique and take it home with them. So then by the late 60s is that this had really spread around the world.
It's always fascinating to me when technology is first presented to the world, how quickly the medical community will grab a hold of it and try to add value to what they're doing in ending human suffering and making surgeries more successful, those sorts of things. And you write in your book that within, and I love this, within 7 years of Edison's invention of the incandescent light bulb, two German doctors were snaking small little light bulbs inside of patients to check their bladders out. Tell us about that.
Well, you understand that this tiny little light bulb was hot, and it had to have an electric connection to it, and so that that was, I think, you know, very innovative and bold to do that. But that it wasn't too many years after that that people began to put these endoscopes with a light on the end of them pretty much through any natural orifice in the body, and then began to even put them into the abdomen. And then as far as orthopedics is concerned, they, by the 1930s, were putting them into joints, particularly the knee joint, because it's accessible and large. But arthroscopy, which would be endoscopy into a joint, didn't really become practical and widespread until the development of fiber optic transmission of light. So your light source could be behind the operating table 10 feet away, and it could be as hot as it wanted to be. But then this cold light through the fiber optic cable was transmitted to the end of the arthroscope so that the joint was well illuminated, but no risk of a bulb breaking in the joint or a electrical failure.
Our guest is Dr. Roy Mills. He's a clinical professor of orthopedic surgery at UCLA. His new book is Bones, Inside and Out. And Roy, you do a historical and anthropological survey of bones. It's quite fascinating. It turns out that human skulls make great bowls, for example. Can you tell us about what other tools are made out of bone?
You name it. The indigenous people, I think, have been as creative as the surgeons have in terms of development of useful bones. But that, the indigenous tribes have certainly made all sorts of weapons, spear points and arrow points out of bone. It's hard, it's readily available, and it's easily craftable. But also domestic utensils, spoons. A lot of times you can understand something about the culture just by seeing the bone implements that they made. I mean, for instance, I've seen louse killers, earwax spoons, snuff spoons, hoes and root hooks and root picks for the garden. Particularly the Inuits, who really didn't have access to wood, and this was prior to their access to metal, is that they the bone was their go-to building material. And I've seen, for instance, interesting toggles for their dog sled harnesses, and the toggles, multi-piece of toggle that were made out of bone. You could go to the hardware store today and find something almost identical made out of metal, but they made it out of bone.
You know, we have a lot of aspen trees here in Park City, and it's known as a softwood, and then about five times harder than aspen is hickory, which is one of the hardest commonly used woods. comparing hickory to bone, I have no idea the difference in density and strength.
I don't think any orthopedic surgeon does either until they first encounter bone in the operating room, and either saw it or drill it. But that I kind of grew up in a woodworking shop, and that I would say that the cortical bone, the outer layer of bone on the surface, it would be about as hard as hickory, a regular old twist drill, and a power drill can drill through it about as quickly as it would for hickory. And then same with the saws. It takes a little bit of concentration, and it would certainly take more effort and time than pine or aspen.
Dr.
I think for a general concept, think of it like hickory.
Dr. Meals, you did a lot of research for your book. What most surprised you as you put this together?
I think I had a fantastic respect for bone before I started, but as I learned more about it, both in its first life as it serves vertebrate animals, and then in its second life where it's repurposed by various cultures for function and pleasure, I had a much better respect for it. The other thing that surprised me is that it's so ubiquitous that I have trouble going to a museum now and not finding something mm-hmm. interesting about bones. You expect that from a natural history museum or a paleontology museum or a whaling museum, but that musical instrument museum is that there are bone fittings in bagpipes, for instance, at the Musical Instrument Museum in Phoenix. I was amazed to see a ukulele that had been made out of an armadillo shell, which is bone.
Right.
And then in fine art museums, Georgia O'Keeffe used bone as a motif for a lot of her paintings, and then Henry Moore really used bone as a motif and idea for his abstract sculptures, particularly his reclining women sculptures, is that he got the idea for these nice curves that joined into each other and holes and openings from picking up pig vertebra bone on the farm where he lived and taking them into his studio as inspirations. So we love going to museums, and I say it's a thrill when I go to a museum with no real intention of studying bone, but then discover something new. So that was truly exciting and continues to be.
And you were speaking earlier about the various uses of bone. And here's one that I found in your book that I really got a kick out of this. In 1932, a man finds a very rich site where there's a lot of dinosaur bones, digs through them, gets 8,000 bones. He tries to assemble them into a single dinosaur, but that didn't work. So since that didn't work, he decides to build a cabin out of the bones, and he calls it the world's oldest cabin. 500 million years old, maybe? But and then you talk in the book about in Siberia how this was sort of something that would happen from time to time.
Well, in first for Bone Cabin, that's in Wyoming, and I recently saw on the internet that cabin is up on a frame and is going to be moved. I don't know anything about where it's going to be moved to. And the bone first appeared about 500 million years ago, but that these dinosaur fossils that Fossil Cabin is made out of are probably more, just a mere 100 or 200 million years old. But that Ripley's does have it as the world's oldest structure. But then, in fact, the indigenous people across Siberia did make winter quarters by using mammoth skeletons, ribs, and long bones from the mammoth skeletons as a framework for a winter house. And in Ukraine and across Siberia, is that a number of these sites have been found. There, maybe this building would be 25 feet in diameter, and now, the bones are just arranged in a collapsed circle, but that these bones were apparently propped up to make a dome-type structure that then they would cover with hides, and then perhaps cover that with soil or moss over that to give them nice winter protection.
Hmm. That's fascinating. Well, we've got time for just one more question, and it's a great word that I learned in your book, piezoelectric. And this has to do with why, when you go see your doctor, they say you have to go lift weights or even run to create stress on the bone to give you better bone density. And it has to do with electric charges. Can you explain?
How about that? Oh, I love it. That's one of the things that makes the bone really remarkable. And that the structure of bone is a composite structure of the calcium crystals being deposited on this collagen meshwork. But the particular collagen crystal that constitutes bone has this property called piezoelectric, where if you put a compressive force on it, if you stress this crystal, is that it generates a small electric charge. And so when you walk or jump, it is that the crystals, calcium crystals in your leg and in your spine, sense this electrical force, and then the body recognizes, the bone cells recognize that as a area of weakness, and so that they move in to deposit more new bone in that area. And so that is the, I guess, the bioelectric basis for the warning about regularly exercising and either use your bone or lose it.
Well, that's great. I'm going to think about that. I don't love to run, but the next time I do, I'm going to think about electrical charges going on all over
that's
my
right.
body. I'm
that's
sure
right.
it will make it less painful.
I'm standing up right now, hopping on one leg, then hopping on the other too. and you don't have to run. Moderately fast walking works. It puts enough force on the bone to stimulate the piezoelectricity. But swimming and cycling, for instance, are great aerobic activities. They're great for the heart and lungs, but they don't impact the bone. So if you're going to keep your bone healthy, you got to walk or jog.
Oh, good. Or in the case of John, I've seen him out cutting the rug or whatever the saying is. He likes to dance. Can you dance?
That's
really?
Oh, I think that'd be fine.
Okay, you're in good shape there, John.
Cutting the rug. All
is,
right.
Is that the saying?
I don't know.
Sounds
good.
I've heard that before.
Yeah.
All right. Well, our guest is Dr. Roy Mills, and his very interesting Survey of Bones is the title of his new book, Bones Inside and Out. Thank you so much for joining us on Cool Science Radio. It's been a pleasure.
Well, thank you, Lynn and John. I really enjoyed talking to you.
Thanks for tuning in to Cool Science Radio.
If you enjoyed this episode, please rate us, give us a 5, and leave us a comment.
Take us along on your next adventure to the moon.
If you have any story ideas, please let us know at coolscienceradio@kpcw.org.
Thanks for listening, and hey, tune in next week.